This is Bloomberg Daybreak Weekend, our global look at the top stories in the coming week from our Daybreak anchors all around the world. Straight ahead on the program, it's the 10th anniversary of the bull market. I'm Bob Moon in New York. We'll take a look at what happened over the last decade and what may lie ahead.
I'm Jessica Summers in New York, where we're looking at upcoming shifts in the U.S. oil and gas export landscape.
As the National People's Congress wraps up in Beijing, what will Chinese officials say about opening up markets to more foreign investors? I'm Doug Krisner, and I'll have that story coming up.
And I'm Marcus Carlson in London, where we're asking if Brexit could be delayed as the UK Parliament gets set for a series of crunch votes.
That's all straight ahead on Bloomberg Daybreak on Bloomberg 1130 New York, Bloomberg 99.1 Washington, D.C., Bloomberg 1061 Boston, Bloomberg 960 San Francisco, Sirius XM 119, and around the world on BloombergRadio.com and via the Bloomberg Business app.
Good day to you. I'm Bob Moon. We begin today's program with the British Parliament voting on the shape of Brexit. UK lawmakers will decide whether to back Prime Minister Theresa May's divorce deal, and if they don't, whether to crash out of the EU without a deal or continue negotiations. Let's turn to Daybreak Europe anchor Marcus Carlson in London for more. Marcus.
Bob, Theresa May suffered a massive defeat 2 months ago when she first put her EU divorce deal to Parliament. The UK Prime Minister's been pushing for changes since, but the European Union has been reluctant about the revisions that pro-Brexit lawmakers say are needed for them to support the agreement. For more about what to expect, we can turn to Emma Ross Thomas here in the London studio. She's Bloomberg's Brexit editor. Also here for the potential sterling fallout, Paul Dobson, managing editor for Rates and FX. Emma, let's kick it off with you. So Theresa May has kicked the can down the road on a number of occasions before, but with only weeks to go before Brexit is supposed to happen, is the high noon moment finally here?
So high noon is probably Tuesday, and so far we still don't know what she is going to be able to bring back to Parliament to make her deal, the deal that she struck in November and that was defeated in January, more attractive to lawmakers. So negotiations are expected to continue, and we will hear from the Brexit Secretary on Monday, and presumably he will tell us then what he has managed to secure from the EU. The problem is that both sides are pretty gloomy. The EU has even made an offer, but it's well short of what the Brits are asking for. So what happens next? If her deal is defeated, then Parliament will be asked to vote on whether they want to take the UK out of the EU into the legal limbo that is a no-deal Brexit. They'll almost certainly vote no. Mm-hmm. And then the following day, they'll be asked to vote on an extension.
An extension to Britain's membership of the European Union, effectively.
Yes, exactly. Postponing Brexit Day. And Theresa May's trump card here really is that she's hoping, I think, to say to the hardline Brexit backers, if you don't back my deal, there is a risk that we will be stuck in the EU for at least another 3 months and possibly forever.
What are pro-Brexit lawmakers in Parliament asking for? Because they're really the audience that Theresa May has been trying to play to in these negotiations with the European Union. What specifically might push this deal across the line on Tuesday?
In the beginning, the Brexit hardliners wanted the Irish backstop, which is basically a guarantee that a hard border won't emerge on the island of Ireland. They wanted that to be removed. They've since softened slightly and said that as long as there was legally binding language that showed that this thing was temporary, they would be happy with that. So about a week ago, it seemed that the hardliners were going a wee bit soft, were possibly scared by the prospect of Brexit Day being delayed and were perhaps coming online. But since then, they do seem to have stiffened their resolve, and now they seem to be thinking that an extension is actually just a postponement of the mm-hmm. cliff edge, and they will still have their chance to push for the no-deal Brexit that they like come June.
Paul, let's turn to you. How nervous would you say that traders and investors are about next week's votes?
Well, I don't want to be too much of a party pooper, but actually the feel that I get from the market is reasonably relaxed. The chances of a no-deal, as market strategists see it, are pretty remote at this moment. They're much more expecting either for it to be pushed forwards into the future by these 3 months, in which case we can worry about it another day, or, you know, there's actually a reasonable chance depending on how the winds blow, of the deal getting through. So both of those would be sterling positive. I think what's interesting is not to look at it so much about the currency maybe, but think about stocks.
Mm-hmm.
And think about the smaller stocks. The FTSE 100 index of large caps tends to move in the opposite direction to the sterling because a lot of the earnings are abroad. But the smaller stocks, the FTSE 250, the next level down, is much more geared towards the UK economy. What people are talking about is if there is a deal, that would be good for both those stocks as well as the currency. But if there's an extension, while it might still be good for the currency, it might be less positive for the companies because there's still that uncertainty hanging over them and holding back the economic growth potential.
I wanted to ask you about sterling and the different scenarios that we've got here. So far, it's been seen as the main conduit in the markets through which the whole Brexit story has played out. Which scenario would benefit sterling the most?
Yeah, definitely at this point, a deal on May's terms would be is basically seen as the best that's likely to be got. You know, I think the markets would go cock-a-hoop were there to be a second referendum, but that's still not really being factored into people's calculations at this point. That's not really being seen as a possibility. So a delay, reasonably good for sterling, might take it up to 133 level based on analyst estimates from around 131, 130 at the moment. But were we to get May's deal through, currency strategists see gains up to 138, something like that. I think what's also interesting is the length of the delay is going to matter for markets as well. If it's only 3 months, that doesn't give the Bank of England time to sneak in a rate hike. If it's a longer delay, then maybe the Bank of England will run out of patience waiting for something to be done on Brexit and start to raise interest rates anyway, which could be, in the interim, a sterling positive move.
Paul Dobson, thanks very much. Emma Ross-Thomas, thanks very much. We're looking ahead to what's going to happen in the UK Parliament next week. It's certainly going to be interesting. I'm Marcus Carlson in London. You can catch us every weekday morning here for Bloomberg Daybreak Europe, beginning at 6 a.m. in London and 1 a.m. on Wall Street. Bob.
Thanks, Marcus. Coming up on Bloomberg Daybreak Weekend, oil executives gather for a major conference in Texas. A preview is next. I'm Bob Moon. This is Bloomberg. This is Bloomberg Daybreak Weekend, our global look ahead at the top stories for investors in the coming week. I'm Bob Moon in New York. Top executives in the oil industry are gathering in Houston for a major conference, and Bloomberg Daybreak television anchor Alex Thiel will be there. She joins us now for a preview. And Alex, tell us about this conference.
Well, they're letting me out of the studio, so obviously it's going to be a big deal if I'm allowed to go. So basically this happens every year. It's called CERAWeek. It's in Houston, and it's all the major players in the oil industry, whether or not you're an oil executive or a lot of the energy ministers like Nigeria are coming. There are a lot of other countries there too, like the Israeli energy minister is also going to be there. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo seems to be there. DOE head Rick Perry will be there. So it feels like a lot of politics this year in the oil community, different than, say, last year, where I feel like it was a lot about sort of shale and producers.
And tell us about some of the themes that you're expecting.
So what I think we're going to hear a lot of is the confluence between, say, President Trump and OPEC and sort of who has control over the oil price and what rhetoric sort of wins.
Mm-hmm.
President Trump, you know, a couple weeks ago said that OPEC needs to relax, that they don't need to cut oil so much. And then the Saudi Arabia energy minister the next day was basically like, nope, sorry, we see the U.S. brimming with supplies, we're still cutting. And that conflict kind of setting up the narrative for CERAWeek. And then as an oil producer, what do you do with that? I mean, some of the things are going to be idiosyncratic to the U.S., like if you're a pipeline operator, right? You got a lot of supply in the Permian, you're going to want to get it out. But if you're Total, what do you do with that kind of push and pull with these two huge superpowers when you have U.S., Russia, and Saudi Arabia, the three top producers, and two of them are still going at each other on this?
Yeah, it looks like the U.S. is just awash in oil right now. Does that continue?
Yeah. So short term, the answer, easy answer, would be yes. The longer term, the answer is I'm not sure. A few years ago, if you would have asked me that question, I would have been like, you bet. I mean, not only do we have a lot of oil, but there's so much money in the technology and R&D right now to get the oil out. It used to be concentrated in the actual drilling, like how you drill and sort of cool technology related to that. Now the cool technology is going to be how do you improve the recovery ratio and get more oil out of what you're already getting out of the ground. That said, what's really interesting now, this is going to get nerdy, guys, get into it, is that there's this thing called parent-child wells. So it kind of is what it is. It's a well that's been there for a while, and then you frack a new one kind of close to it. And what we've noticed is that they interfere with each other. And so companies had come out and said things like, hey, we're going to build, you know, we're going to drill 17 wells. It's going to be amazing. And now they have to come back and say, actually, we can only drill 10. And that winds up reducing their production profile. So that's sort of like a question in the market that no one seems to know how to answer. So that's interesting. On the flip side, you have the majors like Shell, like Chevron and Exxon that are literally all in.
Let me throw a real ringer in here. What is the future of OPEC?
What's your time frame?
Does it ever reemerge? Let me put it that way.
I don't think it can in the same way. It's always going to be some kind of moderator in the market just because they have the third largest producer, Saudi Arabia. So they're always going to control the marginal barrel to some extent. Even if it's in the U.S., they're always going to have control on that. But if you do notice, is that Saudi Arabia is talking up gas a lot. Qatar left OPEC. Many say that's because they want to focus on gas and not oil. Israel is going to be at CERAWeek talking about how to get basically international money into Israel because they have a ton of gas deposits and they want to develop them. So it feels like the future will be gas. Everyone knows that. It's just a matter of sort of who's going to win in that and then what comes next.
So what interview are you looking forward to in the coming week?
I'm talking to the COO of ConocoPhillips. Conoco has a really interesting Alaskan deposit that we're going to talk a lot about. Interviewing the Total head of exploration and production, basically the number two to the CEO. Fatih Birol is the IEA head. We're going to have a 2019 outlook from them. Shell, Freeport LNG, which is an exporter of LNG. Also going to be talking to Equinor, which really has led the way when it comes to oil and climate change. Like, they changed their name, Statoil from Equinor. So they're really the guys you want to be paying attention to. Energy Secretary Rick Perry, Israeli Energy Minister, and I'll also be talking to Bob Dudley of BP and Trafigura, which never gives interviews. It's one of the major trading houses out there, so that's going to be super cool. So I'm pretty pumped about that.
Quite a slate, and you'll hear that, of course, on Bloomberg Television and radio in the coming week. Our thanks to Bloomberg Daybreak Television anchor Alex Steele. Let's see what else is going on in the commodity space. And for that, we bring in Bloomberg's Jessica Summers. Good day to you, Jessica.
Bob, U.S. crude exports are near record highs, and the U.S. and China may be nearing a deal that could lead to China buying $18 billion of fuel from a major U.S. gas exporter. Bloomberg's Oil Trading America's team leader, David Marino, joins me here in New York to discuss the outlook on domestic exports. Great to have you here, Dave.
Thanks.
So let's talk U.S. crude exports. Shipments were above 3 million barrels a day at the end of last month, and we have many pipeline operators in the process of building new lines that will allow oil to be shipped from the Cushing area down to the Gulf Coast. Do you think this will encourage U.S. producers to just go ahead and pump more, knowing their crude can be exported more easily?
Yes, the surge in crude production isn't over by any means, and most of it will need to be exported. So the additional lines from both Cushing and West Texas to the Gulf Coast will allow that to happen. We're at the point where more oil is needed from the U.S., and we even saw supertankers floating empty to the U.S. Gulf earlier this year as OPEC shipments decreased and there was still growing demand for U.S. oil.
And so what impact will growing U.S. crude exports have on the global oil marketplace in general?
The shale boom has already affected flows of oil. We've seen the U.S. become a net oil and products exporter for brief periods of time, and it puts more pressure on OPEC to continue and extend their output cuts and to keep barrels off the market and avoid a glut. And at the same time, as OPEC takes heavier, higher sulfur oil off and the U.S. adds more lighter, low sulfur fuel on, it creates a bit of an imbalance that upsets normal price relationships.
Now, I also want to bring up U.S. liquefied natural gas exports. The International Energy Agency's Fatih Birol spoke to Bloomberg on the topic. Let's take a listen.
U.S. LNG exports are growing very, very strongly. Huge shale gas and LNG one after another projects. Looking at China LNG import needs are growing double digit. Very strong growth.
So there are reports that a deal between the U.S. and China could include a commitment from China to buy $18 billion of fuel from Cheniere Energy, which is really one of the pioneers of U.S. natural gas exports. So what would this mean for Cheniere, and what's expected in terms of LNG exports to China in the future? I know China is the fastest growing market for LNG.
Anytime a supplier can cement a deal and increase a deal with the biggest customer in the world, they're going to be very happy about that. And we've seen the company's shares jumped on news that LNG was considered to be a big part of the trade deal. So it won't be just Cheniere, but other companies that are exporting as U.S. production keeps growing will be looking to Asia to line up deals.
Very interesting. Dave, thanks very much for joining me. This is one of the topics we're watching in commodities for the week ahead. In New York, I'm Jessica Summers. Bob?
Thank you, Jessica. Coming up on Bloomberg Daybreak Weekend, the anniversary of the bull market. I'm Bob Moon. This is Bloomberg.
Broadcasting live to New York, Bloomberg 1130. To Washington, D.C., Bloomberg 99.1. To Boston, Bloomberg 1061. To San Francisco, Bloomberg 960. To the country, Sirius XM Channel 119. And around the globe, the Bloomberg Business App and BloombergRadio.com. This is Bloomberg Daybreak.
I'm Bob Moon in New York with your global look ahead at the top stories for investors in the coming week. This weekend marks the 10th anniversary of the start of the bull market. For more, let's welcome Bloomberg Stocks reporter Sarah Poncik and Bloomberg Stock Market columnist Dave Wilson. And Sarah, let's start with you. About the 10-year anniversary, is this going to go on? How much longer?
It's possible. We often hear that bull markets don't die of old age. And yes, the bull market will now officially be 10 years old. This is the oldest bull market, but we also often hear that it is not the strongest. It's not the most powerful. If you look at the return or the price gain of the S&P 500, I should say, it's risen more than 300% since the bottom in 09. However, if you look at the 1990s, we saw the bull market increased by 417% at its peak. So some people look at that comparison and say, as long as we don't have a recession, as long as earnings don't fall off a cliff, then we could keep going.
Dave, what about it? Is it possible that we could just sort of lumber along for a while?
Look, anything's possible. The point about recession, though, is well taken. It's one thing that analysts have pointed to over time. What killed the previous bull market back in the 2000s? Well, it peaked in October 2007, and by the end of that year, the economy was in a recession. So, you know, you can look back over time and see similar sort of correlations, you might say, between the state of the economy and the state of the stock market. So, you know, that becomes the issue in terms of trying to figure out where we go from here. Now, there's concern among analysts that you may get an earnings recession, two quarters of declines in profit for the S&P 500. Haven't heard as much, though, about the possibility of an economic recession, which does suggest, at least, that stocks have some room to keep rising here.
Sarah, normally we look ahead, but tell me some of the interesting highlights of the past 10 years.
So what is very interesting, LPL Research pointed this out, is that if you look at this current bull market, it is actually the only one ever to exist with two 20% or more declines on an intraday basis. Now, of course, if that had been on a closing basis, then that would have been the end of the bull market. But we always had these bit of an intraday rally, and that saved us because we never quite closed 20% lower. So I thought that was a very interesting fact, just because when people think about a bull market that has healthy corrections, we have had corrections of about 20%. Just when you go with the definition of a market having to close down 20%, we haven't quite hit that threshold.
Yeah, we should back up and say 20% is really a rule of thumb. Right. It's not by any means an absolute. In fact, there are people who will tell you that the bull market we're in right now didn't actually start in 2009 because we had the decline in 2011 that was more than 20% on an intraday basis. Yeah, and you had a similar one in the fourth quarter of last year when stocks hit bottom on Christmas Eve. So, you know, you can talk about definitions all you want. You can say, though, that, you know, over time we've seen stocks move higher. Analysts like to refer to what they call secular bull markets. And, you know, we're not talking about secular versus religious here. We're talking about markets that go through cycles and nonetheless have a direction that can last, say, 10, 15 years. And when you look at things from that perspective, it's still a bull market for sure.
Well, Sarah, when we talk about those little corrections that have happened along the way, could that be the new normal?
That could possibly be the new normal, and some people also say that it is very possible that the high that we saw back in September could have been the end. Of course, we don't know that yet. There are many people who still are saying that we could easily take out those highs, but we are seeing a bit of a pause in the stock market rally. We did see that this past week, but many people do say, look, volatility is back. Volatility is here to stay, even though the VIX has been very, very muted this year. But the reality is that we will probably see more healthy corrections or more damaging corrections if the fact of the matter is that September was not the end.
Well, as we march on into the new week, Dave Wilson, technology stocks have always given us some interesting things to look at. What about this coming week?
Well, I mean, the story, perhaps, if you take a step back, is that, you know, the bigger technology companies and bigger companies in general have kind of reasserted their market leadership. You know, we saw in the fourth quarter that, you know, you think about the FANG stocks, Facebook, Amazon, Netflix, and Google's owner Alphabet. I mean, it really kind of faded, and that was a big reason why we saw the declines that we did in stocks. As far as what we've seen lately, I mean, those shares have been coming back, and companies of that size have done relatively well, too. So, you know, it's like the market's kind of going back to where it was last year to some extent, with those much larger companies sort of leading the way, as opposed to perhaps some of the smaller ones, which we saw in the last few months.
Our thanks to Bloomberg Stocks reporter Sarah Poncik and Bloomberg Stock Market columnist Dave Wilson. Coming up on Bloomberg Daybreak Weekend, a big week for economic data with reports on inflation and retail sales. A closer look next. I'm Bob Moon. This is Bloomberg. This is Bloomberg Daybreak Weekend, our global look ahead at the top stories for investors in the coming week. I'm Bob Moon in New York. It will be a very busy week for economic data in the U.S. following Friday's surprising jobs report. For more, let's bring in Bloomberg Chief U.S. Economist Carl Riccadonna and Yelena Shelektiva, Senior U.S. Economist for Bloomberg Economics. And Carl, let me start with you. This was an interesting jobs report, not so positive on jobs growth, but positive on wage growth.
Exactly. So we have to take the jobs report in its complete context. So often we just focus on that hiring number, which without a doubt was lousy in February. Nonetheless, if we look at, you know, 1 month does not make a trend. And if we look at the broader trend, we're still in a pretty robust situation for the pace of hiring in the economy. But you highlight two other very important points here. The unemployment rate moved lower. So if the pace of hiring really were stalling, we should start to see some backup in things like unemployment claims or the unemployment rate. We did not see that in February. In addition to that, unemployment rate moves lower, and we see average hourly earnings, labor inflation, moving to a post-recession high. So while the payroll number may be front and center at the moment, I think when we look back at this report in a few months' time, the more important takeaway will be that the labor market continues to tighten and wage pressures, in fact, are increasing.
Yelena, stay on wages, if you will, for me. How important is that?
And I would like to add to Carl's point, it's not only the new cyclical high, it's also very much broad-based. And I'm talking about average hourly earnings in the information industry, which requires very highly skilled labor, as well as retail and leisure and hospitality, where we see acceleration in wages. So this is a very positive report in that respect.
Carl, how does the Federal Reserve read this?
Well, I think they're data dependent, obviously, and when you see a stall in the hiring numbers, you don't panic over 1 month's data, but you do raise your antenna to focus on whether or not hiring managers indeed are pulling back. I think this is just a temporary hesitation in response to everything that we saw happening in Q4, including a market rout, a government shutdown, etc. Nonetheless, they should not be too quick to write off what's happening with the wage pressure data, because ultimately, consumer inflation will be dictated by consumer wages and consumer incomes. And the fact that consumer incomes, at least employment income, is running at the strongest pace thus far in 2019 compared to any year of this cycle tells you that consumers are well positioned to continue spending and also to tolerate some modest price increases. So some Fed officials recently, John Williams last week at the New York Economics Club, said he doesn't see inflation on the horizon or more inflation on the horizon. And in fact, I would argue very much the opposite. If wage pressures are increasing, that's going to increase not only input costs for producers, it's also going to mean households having more spending power will be more likely to tolerate those price increases.
On the other hand, and you economists always have another hand, the markets hate uncertainty. If you're an investor, what should you be watching right now, Yelena?
Well, in terms of economic growth, if you think about the payrolls report, the consumer will remain the key driver of economic growth. If you look at what's happening in the markets, maybe it could weigh on, investment potential. So things like growth in investment, that could be a little bit worse, and people are feeling, okay, maybe I'm not going to invest until things calm down a little bit.
Okay, Carl, that's in the past. Let's look ahead now. What are some of the data points that we should be watching in the coming week?
Absolutely. So two key themes, which we've already discussed, retail sales and inflation. Retail sales on Monday will help to provide some context to that thud at the end of 2018. December retails were really a washout, the sharpest since the last recession. We'll look to see if there's any evidence that consumers are getting a little bit more traction in the first part of the year. And maybe there was some sort of idiosyncratic problem with the December report. The government shutdown was happening at the time. The survey was conducted later as a result of that. So there could be some technical issues around that. Watch for retail sales to see if the spending story we're talking about indeed is intact. The other part is consumer inflation, the CPI out on Tuesday, and I think we'll see there that in the service sector especially, inflation pressures still are very much present. We keep saying inflation is low. We shouldn't ignore the fact that core inflation accelerated by 40 basis points in 2018. I think that trend is going to continue into 2019, and that puts us comfortably above the Fed's objective for the first time in a very long time.
Our thanks to Bloomberg Chief U.S. Economist Carl Riccadonna and Yelena Shiletyeva, Senior U.S. Economist for Bloomberg Economics. And now it's time to focus on one of the key events taking place in China this week. For more, let's hand things over to Bloomberg Daybreak Asia anchor Doug Krisner.
Bob, the People's National Congress will wrap up in the coming week, and before it concludes, the head of the PBOC, Yi Gang, will hold a press briefing, and then on Friday, the last day of the Congress, Premier Li Keqiang will conduct a question and answer session. Now, in both cases, we're likely to hear about China's opening up more to foreign investors. If China succeeds, might we see even more volatility in the future? That's a key question. For more, we're joined in the New York studio by Bloomberg's Chris Anstey. He is managing director for the Asian Cross Assets Group at Bloomberg News, normally based in Tokyo. You happen to be here in New York. We are fortunate to have that. Welcome to the program.
Glad to be here.
So here's the question. If China does, in fact, move more aggressively to opening up its markets, this issue of it seems like it's taking on greater urgency right now. Why is that the case, do you think?
There's a number of reasons. China's been talking about opening up its financial markets for many years now. But the greater urgency comes from the standpoint of, you know, they're trying to cushion their growth from the impact of the trade war and from a whole bunch of structural factors. You know, China's economy has grown so fast, it was just bound to slow down at some point. And they've got demographics, a lot of different factors that are causing a kind of a structural slowdown in their economy. And one of the solutions the policymakers are thinking is to pull in foreign capital. There's obviously a financial aspect to that, but also in terms of, you know, the past rounds of stimulus that China has implemented have involved a big buildup in non-performing loans. We're seeing record defaults in the corporate debt markets the past couple of years. So the idea is by bringing in foreign investors, they're going to be bringing global standards of transparency, and there'll be less inefficient allocation of capital.
We can come back to that issue of transparency and the pitfalls that may exist for foreign investors in that. but I'm curious about what the inflow, the potential inflow of foreign capital may mean to the currency and how it may really present a new challenge for the PBOC to keep the currency stable given the inflow of foreign capital that we're likely to see.
That's right. So the whole kind of, acceleration in trying to attract foreign capital came in 2015 when we saw a hard landing scare in China's economy. We saw China's exchange rate decline rapidly. They had a botched mini devaluation. And so they thought, we're going to pull in foreign money. And they have had increasing success at winning inclusion in global bond indexes and global stock indexes. Just last week, we saw the MSCI folks increase the weighting of Chinese stocks in their global index, for example. And everybody right now is focused on, how much are they going to be pulling in? Maybe $100 billion a year in stocks, maybe $100 billion in bonds, according to Citi and others. But the flip side is that the more that foreign investors have at stake in China, the more vulnerable China is to keeping that money on side. And any time that there are questions about the direction of China's economy, there's the potential for that to flow back out, as with any emerging market.
Well, let's go back to that issue of transparency, because the economists that we have at Bloomberg Intelligence were saying that for foreign investors, issues such as insufficient information, lack of transparency, pricing distortions created by implicit government guarantee and price swings in capital flow management are major, major hurdles. Would you agree with that? Pretty fair assessment.
I think Yi Gang, the head of the PBOC, would agree with that. The regulators, the financial regulators in China, understand well that China's financial sector is a long way from the kind of global standards they would like to see.
So if we can agree, then, we are in the early stages of foreign capital coming into China. How might this look like 5 years, 10 years from now? Would that be sufficient time for them, for the Chinese, to get their house in order, so to speak?
I think, certainly the potential is there, and certainly the desire is there on the part of some of these, Western-educated, folks who are running the central bank, who are running the bank regulator. The question is, where does the trade war head? Where does the geopolitical battle between the U.S. and China head? How does that affect foreign investor appetite for Chinese assets? Those are the kind of questions that may play a bigger role in determining just how successful China is in the coming 5 years.
Chris, thank you so much. Great to have you in studio with us. Bloomberg's Chris Anstey. He is managing editor for Asian Cross Asset at Bloomberg News in Tokyo. I'm Doug Krisner. You can join us weekdays here for Bloomberg Daybreak Asia, beginning at 6 a.m. in Hong Kong, 6 p.m. on Wall Street. Bob.
Thanks, Doug. That does it for this edition of Bloomberg Daybreak Weekend. Join us again Monday morning at 5 Wall Street time for the latest on markets overseas and the news you need to start your day. I'm Bob Moon. This is Bloomberg.